accession number 20939 reel 3.
Alec Clark, reel 3.
I thought I saw a light in the water, and only in reflection sometime afterwards I wondered if it was this submarine sailing down the columns of the convoy, because the SO Baton Rouge was right astern of us, and this submarine fired a torpedo at the SO Baton Rouge, and of course the ship went down, and there was a great deal of harm done to the crew as a result of that explosion. And of course, they were picked up by one of the escorts was called the Totland. And he picked up the crew of the Empire Norseman. I don't think there's any injuries there. And then he picked up the crew of the SO Baton Rouge. Now, some of them were very badly burned, so they had to stay on the Totland all the rest of the voyage across the Atlantic. But the next day, we picked up 12 survivors. They rowed across in one of the boats, and they rowed across to us, and we had at least 12 survivors from the Empire Norseman on board the Ethel Regent, the ship that I sailed on. And there was a big Dutch ship, I think it was kind of a passenger boat. I think a lot of the survivors were probably put on this Dutch ship, and then that took them all across the Atlantic. But after that initial attack, we weren't troubled anymore by the submarines, because at that time now, they had very good radar. The American escorts had very good radar, and the British escorts as well. And they were able to ward off the U-boats, but although there was only one U-boat lost in that attack, and that was the one that sunk the Athol Princess. But that one was sunk by the Totland, one of the escorts. But you don't think of danger until afterwards, you know. It becomes part of your life, and I wouldn't say that anyone was afraid. We weren't anyway. I didn't remember that at all. But I'll never forget the leading escort telling us 8 submarines shadowing the convoy about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll never forget that one. That was a U-boat pack, you see. There was 13 altogether. But there was only about 3 or 4 got through to do some damage, because they were well protected. There was about 10 escorts around the convoy, very well protected. And the American destroyers are about 30 knots in speed. So they went to the Athol Princess. There was only one of the engineers was lost, and he was killed by the explosion. American destroyers picked up all the crew except one that was killed on the Athol Princess. So that was my worst experience of submarines during the war in convoy.
What was your attitude towards the U-boat crews?
Oh, and we never thought, well, I can't, I didn't, I wouldn't say I thought anything. The only thing that occurs to me about that is on the Ball Trader, when the third mate, when he saw his pair of shorts getting damaged through a cannon shell through the roof of the cabin where we were, he was more annoyed at that. He wanted to get his own back. And in fact, I'm not so sure. I didn't keep in touch with him. He was anxious to get into the RAF to have a more active participation in the war than what he was doing as a third mate. He was a real daredevil, and he wanted to be up and, he wanted to be at the enemy. But I never felt like that at all. I was there as a peacetime job, and I was happy to shoulder on in the work that I had. I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed wireless operating. And I travelled around the world, saw many places, and had many wonderful experiences. I enjoyed my time at sea. And the fact that it was wartime, well, everybody had their share of wartime experiences. And I was thankful I came through it.
Any other memories from Athol Regent?
The third operator, he was his first voyage. He was a Scot from the Edinburgh area. We went to Curacao, Dutch West Indies. And, of course, he was anxious to buy some bananas to take home. So I don't know what you'd call it, like a branch, great big So he brought this huge thing of bananas. He was going to take it home. So he got permission to store them where the vegetables were kept on the stern of the ship. But of course, the voyage home, it took some time. We had to go up the east coast of America up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and we had to wait for the convoy there. And that was maybe days before you... Anyway, and from there we sailed across the Atlantic. And halfway across the Atlantic, the bananas began to ripen. So what was the sad opening? What was Jim going to do? So I don't know what he did, but I'm sure he didn't pitch him over the side. I'm sure he shared out his bananas to everybody on board with plenty of bananas. But of course, it was his first boy. Little did he realise that bananas were going to ripen. So they all ripened, and they got home with no bananas. We have no bananas today. Good old Jim. We shared a cabin together, so that's why I knew. And he was a fine young lad. And he was very keen on cycling. I remember him telling me about the Larrigrue. It's an important tourist area in the Cairngorms, and how he'd cycled across there carrying his bike onto this pass. And so I think of the weight of bananas he carried onto the ship with him. But it didn't do him any good. Good old Jim. That's the end of my... And of course we paid off, and then we never saw each other again after that, you see. It was the Athol region, yeah. And then, of course, I must have gone home and leave and onto another ship.
That was actually City of...
Cape Town. City of Cape Town, yeah. That little identification, that was my shore pass for New York. It was my first visit to New York. And that ship was the fastest one that I sailed on. It was about 70-knot ship. So when we got out clear of the coastline... We sailed on our own. We didn't need an escort. See, it was reckoned to be fast enough to dodge clear of the convoys. So we went straight across to New York, and of course we moored up at what they call the Island of Manhattan, and I had a lovely time ashore there, and I enjoyed it immensely. And of course that was only just the one voyage. I was the second operator. It was a very weather-wise. It was awful. We ran into a gale, and the captain wouldn't reduce his speed one iota, and the vibration of the ship and the unpleasant nature of the rolling, pitching and rolling was awful. But when we got ashore, when we got to New York, that made up for it.
Why did it make up for it?
Well, there were such a lot of things, so many things to be seen. Radio City, New York, Empire State Building. You see the sights when you go to a place, and it was lovely to be in New York. Close, the ship was berthed in a very handy place to go ashore, and you see, there are streets one way and avenues the other on the island of Manhattan. There's Fifth Avenue, but there's 142nd Street, so it was easy to find your way around. And there was a fascination about New York, just to say that you'd been there, and... You'd seen the sights. It was lovely. So I enjoyed that. And I think I wrote to one of my aunts in Detroit and told them about my interesting trip to New York.
What kind of reception did you get from Americans in New York?
Well, I don't remember much that particular time. I think my visit was rather short. When I went there again... Another ship I went on was the San Volfrano, that was an oil tanker. And we've made a number of visits there. And at that time, it was a little bit later on in the war, and I think that the Yanks were more involved in the war, and they were doing more, they were more on our side. And in New York, we had free tickets for theatre shows, cinemas, and entertainments. You had a choice of entertainments there. And there was all sorts of... the radio programs, there were independent radios at that time, and you could go along to a radio program and you could participate in the program, especially if you're a serviceman in uniform. I remember, I can't remember what the program was about, but I remember I had to go up on the platform and say where I come from. And I think you were given two eggs to eat or something. And the one who ate these eggs fastest got a prize of some kind. I don't know what it was, but I didn't get it anyway. One American, he won the competition and got a prize. But there's all sorts of entertainments. And of course, America was like a peacetime place compared with our country. The bomb damage and the shortage and the scarcity. It was a land of plenty. America was all, it seemed that to me anyway, compared with our old country.
Any other memories from city of Cape Town?
No, no, that was a short trip. No, I just remember going ashore, and there was a senior, there was three operators. If I remember rightly enough, when you got into port, the ship's cranes and derricks were busy operating, loading and unloading cargo, and it was terribly noisy on board ship. So you were glad to get ashore, away from, of course, it stopped at night time, you see, you're all right at night time, but during the day, the noise of the winches and the derricks and the cargo, oh, was bedlam. So it was nice to go ashore. And of course, I was an electrician, a wireless operator, I was free to go ashore because the wireless room was sealed. It was sealed up so it couldn't be used. And so I had more opportunity to go ashore, perhaps with some of the crew who had duties to perform. But once the ship was in port, the wireless operator, the duties were finished until we had time to sail again. But that was the fastest ship that I ever was on, the City of Cape Town. And the only time that we sailed on our own without a convoy.
Did that make you apprehensive to be on your own?
No, not really. No, no. You felt that the ship was a very good ship and a wonderful ship and modern, fast. We never came across any danger of any kind. The worst was the weather, the bad weather, gales and wind that we had to contend with. That was worse than anything else. And if it was bad for us, it would have been worse for the submarines, I think.
And your next ship was called Manchester Commerce?
Oh, yes, I remember that one. Now, the Manchester Ship Canal was in use at that time from the River Mersey. And, of course, the Manchester liners were a well-known shipping company. So it was the Manchester Commerce was the one that I was appointed to. I was the second operator still at that time. And I think I had two voyages. One voyage in the Manchester Commerce. And we went to Boston, in Massachusetts, Boston, Mass. And it was a straightforward voyage across. I can't remember how long. But when I got to Boston, I went ashore. I think it was a Friday evening. I phoned up my Auntie Belle, who lives in Detroit. Oh, she says, Sandy, that was her oldest son, was being married tomorrow. Could you come on to the wedding? Oh, I said, I'll see what I can do. So I went back to the ship, got permission from the captain, gave him the address where I was going to, and so I got permission to go on to Detroit. So I got the first train, but as I was journeying along the train to go to Detroit, before I got as far as Buffalo, I realised that the train was going to be too late to get to the wedding. So I got off the plane, got off the train, and went to the airport to catch a plane. And the cost of the fare was $8.05, and I only had English money. But there was an Italian taxi driver took me to the airport, Frank Mano, and he says, I told him my name. He says, I'll give you the money. So he gave me the $8.05, and that paid my fare to Detroit. So when I got to Detroit, I sent him a $10 bill to cover his expenses for taking me to the airport. And when I got to Detroit on the plane, I found that where the wedding was the opposite side of Detroit. So how was I going to get from one side of Detroit to the other? And there was a couple, an English couple, they were from Leeds, and they saw me in my uniform and they asked me, what was I doing? I said, I wanted to go to this wedding. And of course they knew where it was, so they drove me right across Detroit to the other side of the city, but unfortunately the wedding ceremony has just finished, and so they had gone off to another church for the reception. So there was somebody at the church clearing up, and so I thanked this couple very much for the trip, and the person who was tidying up took me to the wedding reception. So I met my Auntie Belle, Uncle Sandy, and a huge Scottish wedding it was, with bagpipes and all the paraphernalia. There was 5 bridesmaids and 5 groomsmen. What a terrific spread there was. So I was able to go to this wedding in Detroit while from my ship, the Manchester Commerce in Boston. And after the wedding was over, this was Saturday, I think it was the next day, Sunday, I got a train to Burlington, Iowa, in the Midwest, and another aunt there. And so I got to Burlington, Iowa. You just cross the Mississippi, and there was Burlington. And my auntie Grace and her husband Roy and 3 boys, and I got to the barrier, and there they were. So that they were farmers living in a village called Wapello. And so they took me to their farm, and I spent a couple of days with them before I started on my journey back to Detroit and back to Boston. And that was a lovely trip, that. And of course, my auntie Belle loaded me up with silk stockings, Max Factor perfumes, and certain foodstuffs to take back home. So I came back home like Father Christmas, loaded up with good things from the States on the Manchester Commerce. Oh, I remember that. That was a good voyage. And there was no bother at sea with submarines or anything like that. Because by that time, the convoy system was operating very well. And there were ships lost, but I never saw any more danger after that time. That was the Manchester Commerce, back up the Manchester Ship Canal. And that was quite a short voyage, that one.
And then I think it was San Wolframo?
That was another tanker. No, that was a modern tanker. That was what they called the Eagle Oil Shipping Company. A very modern ship. The tankers were very comfy boats, although they were dangerous with the fuel and that. And now I did 2 voyages on that one. I think we had a quick trip across to the States. And then we had, I can't remember the rest of the voyages. I know we went to the Mediterranean because the Americans had landed in North Africa that time. And we went to Algiers with a cargo of oil. We went back to the States. And we went to a number of African countries. Lagos, Takoradi. And then we also went up the River Congo to the Belgian Congo, to a place called Matadi. And we discharged cargo of some oil there. So that was a very long voyage. But I remember that voyage very well. And I call that a happy ship, the San Volfrano. And the second voyage was on that ship. The senior operator and me, we all smoked. Paddy, he was a third operator. We felt we wanted to give up smoking. The wireless room was often like a Kippering kiln with smoke. So the senior operator and me decided to stop smoking. So it took us a fortnight crossing the Atlantic. And for a fortnight, we both kept off smoking, helped encourage each other to give it up. When we got ashore in New York, Joe Dixon, he started again. But I knew I wasn't going to start again. I'd had enough smoking. I'd smoked for 3 years, and I packed it up. And I never smoked since. And I knew that when I stopped, it was for good. And so I didn't bother smoking. I never smoked again after that. That was 3 years.
What was it like at Matadi?
Oh, that was interesting. The Belgians were still in charge of the Belgian Congo at that time. This was a little port on the River Congo. The anchorage was called... Matadi was a mile or so inland. There was an anchorage called Ango Ango, but it was just an anchorage for the oil berth. But Matadi was the town nearest by. So I always remembered Paddy. He was a very strong, ardent Catholic. And of course, on Sunday morning, he got his jacket on and off to church. But however, he didn't have a topi on his head, and he got badly burned, you know, with the sun. He realised after it was rather foolish to try to go through them to do this trip to the church. But anyway, that was Paddy. He was happy to do that. But I went ashore during the week, and I bought a small elephant tusk. Not an ornate one. The Indians have very good ivory carvings, but it was made by... The Belgians were in charge. It was probably made by Africans. And it was a very primitive type of elephant bridge. It only had 3 elephants carved on this elephant tusk. But I remember buying an elephant tusk, an ivory tusk, with some carvings on it from the Belgian Congo, from Matadi. And apart from that... And of course it was... It was very... The roads weren't very good or anything like that. The roads were very poor. But we were very close to the borders. I think it was Angola. I remember Paddy and me going for a walk. And we were going for a walk, and suddenly there was a soldier with his rifle. There was no trouble, but there was this, where he was standing was the border between two countries. So we decided not to go any further because, well, it was another country. We could have got into trouble, you know. But there was no trouble, there was no fighting or anything of that kind. But when we went to this Belgian Congo, you see, when you got to the African coast, you had to take quinine tablets for malaria. But before we got to the Belgian Congo, we had to take another tablet because of sleeping sickness for the tsetse fly. So we had two types of medication we had to take. And the only trouble medically that we had was, as we were going around the African coast, there was one of the young apprentices, he had like a boil that sprung up on his arm. There was two of these things. And when the boil broke out, the little creature crawled out of his arm. He didn't know what it was. The captain didn't know what it was. So when we got to the next port, I think it was Takoradi, the pilot came on board, and he says, the captain was telling him about this insect, this maggot that came out of the chap's arm. Oh, he says, that's the tombo fly. The tombo fly lays its eggs under your skin, and it hatches out. And so he had another one still to come. And the captain was very annoyed because the apprentice had allowed himself to be bitten by the tombo fly. Oh dear, that was on the African coast. Dear, oh dear. That was most unusual to be places to go to on that tanker. We had we were away for nearly about 8 or 9 months, I should think, on that voyage. Went back to the States, and that was the time when we had free theatre shows, cinema shows, and the Yanks were very good to Bertrand Seaman when he went ashore in New York. Plenty of entertainment and things of that kind.
And then?
That was the San Volfrano. Now, what was the next ship I was on after?
Empire Crest.
Ah. Now, you see, as the war progressed, when they got the men signed on the ship, they kept them. So this ship wasn't finished. It was built in Sunderland on the east coast of northeast of England. So we were appointed to our ship, although it wasn't ready. And we stayed in the Manor Hotel in Sunderland. Well, the officers did. The crew stayed somewhere else. So when the ship was building, we would just go down and board the ship and look at the wireless room and see where the equipment was being installed. And so we were standing by the ship waiting for it to be finished. And so I remember having my sister came down from Scotland, spent a few days with me in one of the hotels there. And I remember taking her to Newcastle. What was it? Gone with the Wind was a film that was out at that time. That was a very popular film, Gone with the Wind, an American film. And I remember taking my sister to see this film, Gone with the Wind, in Newcastle, a cinema in Newcastle. And but anyway, this was a small tanker, a new one. And I was only a single operator, this one, because we were going around the coast. And we sailed round. We went to the River to the Firth of Clyde, and the ship went through its paces, and it went on the measure mile to see the speed of the ship, and various preparations for military warfare was, you know, we had nets that we would hang over the ship's side. They were to catch torpedoes that were fired at the ship. Well, some planes, for practice, they fired torpedoes at the ship, but none of them were caught in the net. So what happened, what kind of planes they were, and their accuracy, I couldn't tell you. But none of the torpedoes hit the nets. But the nets were lowered in the water. That was the idea, to protect them from torpedoes, if they were out at the Atlantic, you see. But from the Firth of Clyde, I can't remember what the speed of the ship was, but that wasn't my interest. But we went down to the Southampton docks, drifted to Southampton, to Fawley in Hamble, and we took oil across the... By this time, the D-Day landings had taken place, and the war was well on into Europe. And we took about 30 cargoes of oil to Cherbourg, some to Le Havre. And apart from some mine activity, mines being exploding, there was no sign of the war, although we could see the destruction. Cherbourg was pretty well destroyed. Le Havre was very badly blitzed. But we were quite safe on the ship going across. So that was the Empire Crest. But I was just a senior. I was just on my own in that ship. But it was just another job of work for me. I didn't have much to do because we were within sight of land. You know, we just had a cross. I didn't have to use the wireless very much. I didn't have to do very much at all. It was just a question of having an operator on board in case it was necessary to send a distress message or something like that. I used to keep watch, but I didn't think I was doing very much, apart from just doing my job.
Did you ever have to send a distress message?
The senior operator did on the Ball Trader when we were attacked by a German plane out in the Atlantic when we lost the convoy. The senior operator did. No, but what I did have to do on one occasion, on a later ship, I can't remember if it was the Empire Bardolph, but we went to Freetown to load a cargo of iron ore. And the captain was warned, this was towards the end of the war, this must have been after.
Yes, you were in the Empire Bardolph in the autumn of
45. Yeah, well, now the war, peace had been declared with Germany. And there's a lot of stowaways getting onto the ships and getting up to England. And the captain was warned about this. But when we left Cape Town, there was 8 stowaways come up from the stokehold, as black as the coal in which they were hiding. And God, was he annoyed? Oh, the captain, God, he got all these men up on the boat deck outside his cabin. He got out his revolver. And my cabin was just beside, next to the captain, you see, on the bridge, on this, the captain's deck. And I could, the captain wanted these men to go down one of the holds as punishment. But one of them was a ringleader. And they wouldn't go down the ship's hold. Anyway, there was no further incident. So I had to send a message to Radio Freetown. 8 stowaways found on board. Wish permission to transfer them to a ship that was outward bound. But the Admiralty wouldn't give permission for that. They said, take the men back to Liverpool. And so I had to send a message on shortwave to say about these stowaways. But there was no danger. It was just a commercial message, as you might say, about things that were happening on board the boat. That was the only time I had to send a message of any noteworthy value.
So were they South Africans trying to get to England?
No, from Freetown, no, Africans, real Africans. Freetown is...
Sierra Leone,
that's right. Oh, yes. They were... it used to be called the white man's grave because of the danger to white people there with the malaria and those things. But no, they were real Africans from that part of Africa, and they wanted to get back to England. They thought it was a better life there, of course. But what happened to them after that, we don't know. But I always remember the captain, and faced with 8 stowaways. I mean, if they'd been one, but 8 of them, God, they'd stowed away in the stokehold amongst the coal. God, was the captain annoyed. And I could hear him, he had his revolver on the deck, and I could hear the noise going on, but I didn't bother even looking out the porthole because I thought, well, something might happen. But they didn't go down the stokehold. They didn't go down the cargo hold. But they had to work the passage, of course, on the ship. God, Captain, dear, oh dear. That was a do.
Going back to Empire Crest, any more memories about that one?
No. It was a small tanker, and everybody had their job to do, and I feel I had rather an easy job. I don't remember sending any messages. There was no great danger. There was nothing much to worry about. The war was progressing well into Europe, No, I can't tell you much more about the Empire Crest. It was quite an easy job. And that wasn't a very big ship, no. It was a modern ship, of course. I don't know if it was much... It was probably bigger than the Ball Trader, yes, it was. It was perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 tons, but it wasn't a big ship as such. I would call it a smallish tanker, smallest tanker I was on during the war.
And I think your last ship in the war was Fort Cabot River?
No, I think it was the Sam Constant. The Fort Cabot River, that was a Canadian-built ship, wartime ship, and I did two voyages across to one to Newfoundland, where we loaded a cargo of wood for Immingham, and then the next one we went to St. John, New Brunswick.